Catherine Nuremberger has been accused of writing really long poems and often short essays, but she likes to think that good writing defies categorization.
So I've joked in the past that I guess I'm like an oppositional defiant writer, where what I just want to do is thwart my readers' expectations and refuse to give them what they asked for.
But what you'll get is an interesting mix of science, history, and a woman's view of the world. Stay with us for her poetry and essays today on New Letters on the Air, a production of New Letters Magazine at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. I'm Angela Elam, and I first interviewed Catherine Nuremberger in 2017, just after she received an NEA fellowship in literature. She was teaching then at the University of Central Missouri, where she also directed Pleiades Press, and her second poetry book, The End of Pink, had received the James Laughlin Award from the American Academy of Poets. The following year, the Missouri native moved to the University of Minnesota, but she returned in 2019 as a guest of Rockhurst University's Midwest Poet Series. We caught up with her newer work, including her essay book, Brief Interviews with the Romantic Past. Here's the opening essay from the first section called Heirloom that reflects her research into hot air balloons and her discovery that many aeronauts had been women.
Float Cleave. Like most everything, the history of hot air balloons is a history of sex and tragic death. In response to a suggestion that the desire to float passively upon the currents of air represents the female principle, while the urge to cleave through them upon aggressive wings typifies the male, L.T.C. Rolt, author of the seminal history, The Aeronauts, insists, "The fact is that the floaters were the first to win the skies, and it is with their victory that we are here concerned. It could not be claimed as a victory for feminism." His tone is one of revulsion at the very suggestion a man's gambit might take a woman's form. To be borne aloft for the first time by a frail envelope of paper or silk, a man needed as much courage as a tower jumper. I try not to talk about being a woman because I don't want to be defined that way. I try not to talk about religion or politics because I am at odds with the people where I live. I try not to talk about my opinions because who cares? I try not to talk at all, but sometimes I find myself saying just anything. "Did you know," I once told the men at the coffee shop who wring their hands over socialized medicine, "that there have been times being a woman was so different from being a man, it was easier to imagine yourself a drifting balloon than the man below trying to steer." A well-known poet read at our university, and one of her poems was a metaphor for the female orgasm as a bird beating its wings like a second heartbeat. I returned to my office to find one of the professors of the old guard waiting in the hallway to ask if this is, in fact, how the female orgasm feels. I had been a professor myself for less than 2 months at this point, so I changed the subject. He asked again, and I suggested he ask his wife. Not one to be put off, he said, "I'm not asking my wife, I'm asking you." He's a jolly and affable man, and urgent curiosity about questions related to the pleasure of others is to be commended. Nevertheless, I told him to leave my office and take his sexual harassment with him. I didn't know what kind of person I was going to have to be then. I was wearing a new pair of dress slacks and never spoke of my still nursing child, who I sometimes could see in a fountain at the center of campus beside her father, who gave a little wave toward my window. That night, I was impatient for my daughter to go to bed so I could ask my husband, "Can't you feel it for yourselves, the bird pulsing to the nest?" I thought I was the bird. Tomorrow, I will eat in the school cafeteria with this professor and my now kindergarten-age daughter, who says he is her best friend. He will ask her difficult questions like, "What is it like to be young?" "Well," she'll say, chewing her French fry like a cigar she's been contemplating as the sun goes down, "sometimes it can be exasperating to be five, but mostly it's pretty good." And then we'll talk over the child's head for a while about his wife's diagnosis, which he is right to worry about. Everyone in this little town we all share adores her for how often she appears at a convenient moment to pull her husband out of an intense conversation by his elbow. I've lived inside my careful silence so long, though, I prefer not to see him nudged away. When he told me about her prognosis, it was a secret. If she lived, there was a lot the disease could still take from her. Some things are harder to tell than that you're going to die, but some things are also hard to know alone. I write the history of aeronauts instead. When Benjamin Franklin's gout got so bad it took four strong men to carry him into assembly, he made sketches for the patent office of a hydrogen balloon chair apparatus that would require only one man lightly steering. How can you not admire a person who thinks of air before wheels? I wish I had told my friend that of course an orgasm is like a second heart beating a wing-flapping bird. That's why the poem was so good. Even I didn't know there was a bird in there. But now I feel it every time. I should have thanked him for asking.
That was the opening essay called Float Cleave from the book Brief Interviews with the Romantic Past by Katherine Nuremberger. And this was published by Mad Creek Books, which is an imprint of the Ohio State University Press. I love that piece. That's a great way to open because it shows your sense of humor, which really bubbles up all throughout your poetry and your essays. But the way you depict other human beings and then your interest in science, I mean, how you start off with hot air balloons and then end up where we end up going in this essay is fascinating to me.
The world is so full of weird thinkers saying weird things that are really delightful to me. So, like, I'm not sure if it was totally clear there, but there was this whole school of conversation and thought among theorists that were doing Freudian work in like the late 60s and early 70s about the balloon itself being an envelope, and an envelope is the opposite of the phallus. And then the tower jumpers were very phallic.
Who comes up with this
stuff? I know. I was not aware that we were flying into the air on each other's genitals. So just sort of teasing that out and thinking about the implications of, if that were true, how weird it is to be alive with each other.
It's amazing to me. One thing that you wrote in this particular essay, I try not to talk about being a woman because I don't want to be defined that way. But it does seem to me that a lot of your writing is about being a woman, even from the title poem of your book, The End of Pink, which has to do with the nipple after you've had a baby and how that changes. And I won't make you read that since we had you read it in the other program that we did with you, which people can listen online to at newletters.org. But it does seem like the fact of being a woman plays a large part in it, and especially in this essay, which is very timely right now with the whole Me Too movement. I mean,
oh yeah. In fact, you know, I wrote that essay before the Me Too movement was so much a part of our conversation. I feel like I would write that essay very differently now, because I sometimes feel like maybe I'm saying, like, oh, women being harassed, you should just be more understanding of your harasser. And I definitely don't think you should be, you know, burn it down. But I wrote from a place where I thought I would be living that life in that place forever. So the way I would talk about experiences varies depending on where I'm at in my life at different moments. And then the very experience of writing, by the time I've written an essay, I've talked myself out of whatever I kind of said in it. So that line, for example, that is a thing I thought when I was younger. I don't want to be thought of as a woman. Like, I don't want to be a woman writer. I just want to be a writer. And now I'm very happy to be a woman writer. I was afraid earlier in my career that I'd get pigeonholed and it would, like, close down opportunities for me. And I'm not naive. That might still be true. But I'm also aware of what we give up when we try to be people that we aren't or can't even be. You know, like, I'm just not willing to give up this life by pretending that it doesn't matter to me that I'm a woman or that my experiences don't matter. You know, like, I've just decided to lean into the being in a woman body, having a domestic component to my life that is shaped by cultural expectations around women, and also being pissed all of the time because of things that are related to my gender, and to let all of that be subjects that are fair game.
Brief Interviews with the Romantic Past. Tell me what you were doing when you decided to put this book together.
I think my training as a poet shows a little bit in that a poetry collection will have many different subjects, you know, whereas I think it's more typical for books of essays to perhaps be more firmly constellated around a specific theme. And in this book, the first half is about the hot air balloons, and then it kind of, a lot of the hot air balloon things were happening in France, and so it morphs into, like, the surrounding period of the French Revolution and Enlightenment ideas. And then the second half of the book was largely composed of, I was taking oral histories from my in-laws who live down in the Ozarks, and my poor dear husband, every time we drove anywhere, I'd take out my notebook and be like, tell me the one about the cave. And and of course, he loves to tell them all. Like, he'll tell you the one about the cave anytime you ask. But I was like, writing as he was talking, and I'd be like, hold on, I can't catch up, and trying to catch up with the tales. And he was like, just record me. And because I'm not a folklorist or an anthropologist, there was something about writing what he was saying and that slowing down that was helpful to my process, even if it was infuriating to him because he couldn't always, like, get into his groove. So wait, we had many car squabbles. And then I was there to make Christmas really weird by being like, hold on, everybody, I'm going to write down what you're telling me.
They must think he's married a strange one. This. What do they think of you and your poetry life?
Oh, I think he's married a strange one, probably, is accurate.
What does your husband do?
He's also a writer. For a long time, he worked as a water quality specialist in our rural county in Ohio, and he worked as a scientist in various capacities or as a field researcher. But after our child was born and I got a tenure-track job here in Missouri, and we were very far from a place where he could continue to do that science work, he stayed home with her, and we met in college in a creative writing class. But his life had gone in this very other direction from mine, and then slowly that sort of early writerly self came back out. So now he's writing a novel, and he's a really great fiction writer.
That's interesting. You embraced his science, and he came back and embraced the writing.
Yeah.
Life.
It's been a very fruitful, collaborative sort of experience, this life together we have.
That's really neat.
He's always my editor and often a character, and sometimes that's complicated for him. Like, remember that day I was really mad at you? Will you please read this poem and tell me if it's good? And he'll be like, super painful. I think you need to publish it.
That's good. I'm talking with Catherine Nuremberger today for New Letters on the Air. I'm Angela Elam. All your books have been printed by different presses. Boa Editions came out with The End of Pink earlier, and then before that, it was Elixir Press. Mm-hmm. And who's coming out with your new book?
Boa's going to publish Rue as well. So
nice.
So Boa's my poetry
your
home
poetry.
For the moment. Yes.
Yeah, that's a good home to be in.
I sure do like them.
Yeah, that's really wonderful. Well, we're going to peek back at The End of Pink before we get into some of your new poetry and this poem, Rene Descartes and the Clockwork Girl. And I'm assuming the research came out of something he tried to do, but then you take it to almost like a dreamlike stage. Talk about that poem.
Sure. I think Descartes' writing was maybe like the first thing I was assigned in college. And I remember feeling so stupid and then so disappointed because I thought I was very smart, but I just didn't get it. So he's got this whole idea in his philosophy that you would start by imagining yourself like only a mind with no body. Like, let's imagine we're nothing but a mind and then try to like rebuild the world just with our mind. And he was arguing that you could probably do that. Like right away, I was like, I didn't notice that. I was screaming in my head. I was like, no, you totally can't do that. Or I couldn't imagine how to do that. And so that was like my initial breakdown. It took me years to realize like, oh, I just can't imagine that. So Rene Descartes and the Clockwork Girl. In man, it was written, are found the elements and their characteristics, for he passes from cold to hot, moisture to dryness. He comes into being and passes out of being like the minerals, nourishes and reproduces like the plants, has feeling and life like animals. His figure resembles the terebinth, his hair, grass, veins, arteries, rivers, canals, and his bones, the mountains. Then the vascular system was discovered. Pump and pulley replaced wind and mill, sweeping blood down those dusty roads. And Descartes, the first to admit he supposed a body to be nothing but a machine made of earth, mere clockwork. He found this a comfort because you can always wind a machine back up. The chimera was a clock in the form of a leviathan. Memento mori was the shape of skull. Spheres and pendants, water droplets and pearls. Milkmaids tugging udders on the hour. Some kept time using Berthold's new equation. Some invented the second hand. The silver swan sits in a stream of glass ripples and gilded leaves, swallowing silver-plated fish as music plays. After Descartes' daughter died, he took to the sea. They say he went so mad with grief, he remade her as automaton, a wind-up cog and lever elegy hidden in the cargo hold. He said the body is a machine, and he may well be right about that. But when she was so hot with fever, she could not breathe, and then so suddenly cold, he held his fingers on her wrist and felt only his own heart pumping. All the wind and water of a daughter became a vast meadow that has no design and no function, and there is no way beyond that stretch of grass. Grief, the sailor said, is a hex and contagion, and it will draw the wind down from the sails. It will stop her in the glass jar, sitting like a heart in the chamber of a mechanical girl with mechanical glass eyes. On a ship beleaguered by storm, they ripped open the box with a crowbar to find the automaton Descartes called Francine, because he missed saying her name. They threw her into the wake, and his face became a moon in the black deep, each wave lapping it under. He supposed that if you thought hard enough, you should be able to understand, for example, how a stick would refract in water even if you had never seen a stick or water or the light of day. By this means, he said, your mind will be delivered. If you think hard enough, you can light a fire in the hearth. Your child can press herself against your knee and snug her shoulder into yours as you wind the clock of a girl, like and unlike her, who can walk three remarkable skips and blink and curtsy politely before ticking down. It may be there is no wind blowing blood through the body, but, arm around her, you feel how she flushes with fiery amazement as she puts her little hand over her own cuckooing heart, because this is what we do when Papa has taken our breath away.
René Descartes and the Clockwork Girl. That's from the second collection of poetry by Catherine Nuremberger called The End of Pink, which was the winner of the James Lachlan Award in 2015, and the book was published by Boa Editions.
The book, The End of Pink, a preoccupation while I was writing was that I had a miscarriage, and so I was often thinking about metaphysical questions of, like, what is a body? What is a mind? How do those things fit together? Where does a soul come into play? And I was just grieving. The way I've talked about it since then is I was grieving a being that was a baby to me, but I don't want to impose that on anyone else. You know, like, I don't want to make an anti-birth control or anti-abortion argument about the fact that I was sad about a miscarriage, but I was really sad. So I was going back thinking about Descartes, wanting to kind of understand again this mind-body dichotomy, and then sort of stumbled on a few things, stumbled on the idea that he was the beginning of this idea that the body's a machine as opposed to an ecosystem. And I was like, oh, I feel like the ecosystem thing helps me understand myself and fertility and all kinds of things a little differently. And then the other thing that I found interesting, though, was that he'd lost a child who was like 7 or 8, I think. And so that part's all true. And that as part of his experiments with this idea of, like, oh, we're machines, our bodies are machines, and they work like machines and we can predict them, was that he had just created this automaton. And then it's like, as a joke, he named this doll that could move around and talk that was like a clock after his daughter. And then I think he was sailing to visit Queen Christina or something. Anyway, so he really did have this wind-up doll in a boat. That's true. I think it's true. I mean, it's like somewhere in between true and folklore. It's true that people have told this story about him for a long time, and that the sailors, like, saw this thing and they were super freaked out.
Because even though people were experimenting with automatons, they weren't exactly a common thing.
Yeah, right, so, right. I mean, the idea that you would make something that would look very human. And I don't know, I feel like I'd be freaked out if somebody got on a plane with their automaton child. Especially, like, somebody, they were grieving the way I was grieving, you know? Like, anyway, so the sailors threw this doll off the boat, and I was like, oh, that would be so sad. And also, do you empathize with the sailors? That's a pretty weird thing to do, walk around the world with your fake robot.
Your fake daughter.
You know, he'd named her Francine as a sweet joke with his kid before, but then, like, the way that would be so haunting after.
Did you know when you were writing this that you were dealing with your own grief, or is that something you realized later?
That poem, no, I think I made a lot of choices. I knew I was putting things I couldn't figure out how to talk about in my own life in a personal way onto René Descartes.
Yeah. Is that part of the drive to write, do you think? Is exploring the world outside you, but also the world within you?
Oh, sure. How do I know what I think until I see what I say? Is that sort of, I don't actually remember who said that quote, but I think most writers I know anyway tend to repeat that one because it's such a nice description of the pleasure of writing, right? It's like, oh, I don't know what I think until I write it. And then for me, like, the essays in particular, I write them. And then by the time I've written, like, the essay is done, but I'm like, oh, I don't even think the things I said there anymore. But, you know, they become this archive of a way I was thinking at a moment in time. But the next moment of time, I'm just thinking totally differently.
Well, this is a good jumping off place to your even earlier book, because I thought I would have you read something from Rag and Bone. Mm-hmm. Your poems that were published by Elixir Press. And this one was so unafraid to show humanity in not the nicest way possible. And it's called A Nice Girl.
Oh, yeah. A Nice Girl. I was traveling with a man I wanted to love. It seemed ethical. When we got high, I promised to love him forever. He said I was the best thing that ever happened. He'd quit the cocaine, but too late to straighten a deviated septum. After the surgery, his face was all bruise. If we'd stayed, the doctor could have told him the skin graft in his sinus was dying. Instead, we took off with the painkillers to see some band in Miami. 3 days sleeping in the Coral Court Motel, and I wondered if love was nothing more than the strength to be kind. He started by kissing my ear. I smelled something, dead maybe in the furnace or behind the wall. I couldn't concentrate when everything was so rank, when the stench got worse each time he leaned for my mouth. He was tender and devastated, sitting naked on the end of the bed. "It's me," he said. "It's me who smells rotten." But he couldn't smell a thing. My cheek prickled with the small stabs of loose stitches. He couldn't feel those either. This was what I deserved for following him in the first place. A nice girl would have kissed him, straddled him on that stained mattress. She'd never have left him sitting alone in a white plastic deck chair, watching the tide dump black seaweed on the shore as he held a rag filled with ice to his face.
Oh,
I know. That poor guy who's maybe not even a real person. Maybe I made him up.
Yeah, exactly.
Often women don't get taught how to say no at all. We're taught how to be nice and to always think about other people's feelings. And, you know, the first essay I read, even now as an adult, I'm still doing it, right? I'm still writing essays where I'm like, no, the most important thing was that I thought about the complexity of this person's feelings as opposed to, like, really leaning into the equally legitimate complexity of what it's like to be me. So anyway, which is to say, like, I look back at that 20-year-old Kate and I'm like, just break up. Like, it's no big deal. You're just like, no, I don't care to date anymore. And I owe you no explanation at all. But instead, I got myself in these really weird, twisted up situations where I was like, anything not to have to say no to somebody.
That was A Nice Girl from the collection Rag and Bone by Katherine Nuremberger. And this was your first collection, right? And
it was
published by Elixir Press back in 2011 after winning the Anti-Venom Prize.
It makes me so happy that that's the name of that prize. I mean, I love the books Elixir publishes, and I feel like I knew I belonged there when they had a prize called Anti-Venom.
I know. That's wonderful. We should mention, too, that Brief Interviews with the Romantic Past was the winner of the 2017 Nonfiction Prize from the Journal. It must be nice to know that all your books have won awards.
Everybody should win prizes. It feels great.
Well, you have a book coming out in 2020, and I was lucky enough at the Midwest Poets Series, the reading that you gave, to hear kind of a preview of things coming up in that. And so I thought I would have you read a couple of poems from that. And one of them is the title poem, Rue.
Sure. Rue. I started researching all of the flowers that were growing in my pasture when I was living on a homestead in Missouri. And it turns out an awful lot of them have all kinds of medical properties, but often their historic uses had to do with birth control, as well as all the other things they could be used for. And I just thought that was really interesting. To live in a state where we had a campaign where someone would talk about the idea that there could be legitimate rape, and to then look out at my field and see all of these plants that women had used to safeguard their ability to have choices just growing out my back window. So, Rue. "Let's try again," he says. "I could, but I wear this pressed flower around my neck as all the girls once wore a charm, and it will not let me believe never anymore a promise. I could, but the archangel gave Adam yellow blossoms of rue that he might have clear sight, and Eve, merciful midwife that she was, snuck her own bouquet. I could, but it is rue in St. Hildegard's curious book of visions and apocalypses that is the remedy for melancholy. I could, but rue is bitter, hence regret, and rue is the antidote to plague, hence the fair maidens. I could, but the basilisk's breath, which causes plants to wilt and stones to crack, has no effect on rue. But the weasels who hunt the snakes first gorge themselves on rue, the herb of grace, and grave robbers in shackles traded the secret recipe to the vinegar of the four thieves for their freedom. Rosemary, sage, lavender, rue, wormwood, meadowsweet, cloves, campanula roots, 2 ounces of angelic, 3 pints of strong white vinegar, whorehound, and large measures of camphor protects the wearer against pestilence and plague. I could, but could you tell me the name of even one such star that constellates the ocean of these endless brown fields? Our Savior rebuked the Pharisees, their superstition in paying tithes in rue. The priests used rue to see the witches, and the witches used rue to see the priests. Da Vinci and Michelangelo both took rue to preserve their vision and keep it sharp. I could, but blind men can't paint virgins. I could, but when I wanted to, you were nowhere to be found. I could, but I like you better when I hardly recognize you this way. I could, but for how Rue loves the rocky sandy soil, but for how it makes a yellow meadow of this fall down stone wall. I could, but I don't even think I could. I could, but I don't think I will.
That's the title poem of the forthcoming book, also from Boa Editions, called Rue. You certainly know the plants and the flora and fauna because you lived on a farm in Missouri for years. Mm-hmm. Was it outside of Warrensburg or Columbia, Missouri? Kind of in between the two?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And before that, I lived on a farm on the banks of Sunday Creek near Gloucester, Ohio, too. So yeah. I tried to get to know those flowers as well.
And so the natural world comes up a lot in your work. Mm-hmm. Since you've now left Missouri, I think I'm going to get you to end with a poem that last night you called your love poem to Missouri. And it's called, I Want to Know You All.
I Want to Know You All. I was listening to this sort of ignorant blowhard go on about how teaching is a dumb profession. And I did this thing I always do, which is feel smug about how smart and sophisticated I am. But my smugness is a little compromised lately by how I do almost nothing all day besides have an affair in my mind and then wring my brain over what a divorce would do to my daughter, who heretofore has been lucky to have a happy, close family, not even too far off from how we pretend to be in public. So I just kept listening, without my hackles up so much, and also was bemused about how alike we all are, admiring some people, judging others, thinking we're so special. And this guy had some good stories. One time, a history professor in college told him to go hang himself after he wrote 500 words about pheasants in the French Revolution. He said he must have mentioned those fired-up and pitchfork-wielding pheasants a dozen times in that paper. That exasperated historian screaming peasants in the margin always reminded him of his dad, who does probate, which is basically a ton of archival research into plat maps and deeds, birth certificates, and death wishes. There are no secrets when someone contests a will. His dad once told him, "You wouldn't believe the number of cross-dressing farmers there are in Missouri," which made me laugh at first at the hypocrisy of this place, but then realize it's actually tragic, how alone those farmers must feel. It's ruthless out here, I know. All the longing we till under, only to let such a secret slip. Probate means some cousin or sister or brother described the dress in front of a judge who considered it fit evidence against a claim. I laughed because I can't imagine who you are. The man in coveralls who mocks the foamy fern I like poured onto my latte. The one who calls me hun that condescending way. Or are you the one always with the sign in front of my doctor's office, or the neighbor who mows the waysides of our country road down to stubble? Maybe you don't come to town if you can help it anymore either. I want you to know, whoever you are, as someone hungry for variety in the human condition, most especially my own, cross-dressing farmers, you light up the fields for me. I hope you walk into those soybean rows some nights and your flowered skirt swishes your legs in a way that feels like falling in love, when you didn't think you ever could. Or maybe you feel rooted, belonging to this soil that made you. I don't know what's better, but I want for you such happiness and every last acre your bigot of a father left behind to go with it.
Catherine Nuremberger reading from her forthcoming book, Rue, when she was in Kansas City for Rockhurst University's 2019 Midwest Poets Series. For links to her other three books, Rag and Bone, The End of Pink, and brief interviews with the romantic past, visit newletters.org. Subscribe to our free weekly podcast and follow us on Facebook, Tumblr, and Twitter. A production of New Letters Magazine at UMKC, today's show was produced with Natalie Stein, Robert Zimmerman, Ashley Cote, and Jamie Walsh. I'm Angela Elam. Thanks for listening to New Letters on the Air.